Recorded live in the Phantasmo Lounge, high atop the Charlie Gamora building in beautiful Midtown Portsmouth, Virginia, it's Phantasmo After Dark, with your host Rob Floyd and special guest co-host Dr. Clayton Sayre. Tonight's topic, Planet of the Apes, and everything that has to do with it. Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome back to the old podcast, and welcome, Clayton.
I am excited to be here. I'm so excited. It's a good thing my pants are baggy.
Well, you know, and I appreciate that. The excited part and the baggy pants part.
That's
for the benefit of our younger lounge
there's plenty of preschool toys present.
Oh, man, this is something we've been talking about doing for a long, long time.
Yes, well, and the thing of it is we do it all the time anyway. Well,
and it's something we've been doing for a long time. I mean, you know, Jesus, we've been talking about Planet of the Apes for, what, well over 20 years now.
Oh, shoot. Almost, I think we're up to 25, maybe push it towards 30.
And there is rarely a conversation between us that goes by that apes is not mentioned in some way, fashion, or form.
Isn't that the truth? Well, because apes binds everything together.
It does. The world revolves around apes, and if you don't believe us, we will prove that by the end of this podcast.
Indeed.
Who knows? This may be a two-parter. It may be a five-parter. I don't know. We'll see. We're just going to start talking and ride it out. So,
yes.
So
Yes, doctor.
So we're not gonna sit here and give a synopsis for each movie, because if you haven't seen these movies by now, stop listening, go out, get the movies, watch them, and then come back and listen to the podcast.
That's right. Yeah.
No, don't do that. Listen to the podcast and then go watch the movies. Don't stop listening. What kind of asshole am I to just stop listening?
That's right. All five people out there just went to the store.
Yeah. It's crickets now. But no, I mean, you know, man, they are such great movies and so much fun. And I watched a few of them this week. Rewatched the blue. I got the Blu-ray set. You've got that, don't you?
No, I'm in a lesser. I'm still watching Super 8 over here.
I was gonna say, you're still hand cranking.
hey, you know, that's personal business, buddy. Yeah.
Put the clothes back on that zero figure.
That's right. Hey, that was a whole episode there. Okay, come on.
We'll talk.
I have not ventured out to the Blu-ray because I'm like you. I have so many damn movies. I'd have to replace everything.
Well, I tell you know, I've just started to get. I don't have a ton of Blu-rays. I just get special stuff, and if something's on sale, you know. But Apes, I had to get the Apes one.
Well, you know, that would be my first thing I'd go out and get. Follow the Apes.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, brother, you got to do it because it's got some cool stuff. Each disc is introduced by an animated lawgiver and talks a little bit about the movie, and then the movie plays. And the extras, all the extras, each disc has extras on it, behind-the-scenes stuff, interviews, you know.
It is behind the Planet of the Apes, the documentary, is that
no,
on there?
No, I don't think so. I don't
the
think that's on there.
Okay.
It's odd little stuff. In fact, I was watching the one for Battle today, and it had some really cool stuff about how the uniforms, the costumes were reused, and like Virgil's outfit is the shirt under the coat is actually from a chimpanzee costume from an earlier movie, and the Ursus top, his jacket, his armor top
is Aldo's. Yeah,
no, it's from, well, it might have been used for Aldo later, but it's from a movie called Barabbas. About Roman, like gladiator stuff. I never knew that.
Oh, really? No, I didn't know that either. Wow. You mean the part with the studs in it?
Either that, or I don't know if they said the whole top, but, you know, at least that part.
Oh, wow. Hmm.
So we'll have to go check that out. Something, you know, these movies have been out for, what, well over 40 years?
40 years.
And we're still finding that.
We're getting up to, we're almost to 50 years.
Yeah. And
1967.
Well, so. Yeah. You know, as big of fans as we are, we're still finding out new stuff about them. I mean, how cool is that?
Well, that's, I mean, shoot, there are some some great sites online that are just resources.
Oh, yeah.
For photos and behind the scenes, little bits of information. So.
Now, have you seen the unedited cut of Battle?
Yes.
I mean, not Battle. Conquest.
Conquest.
Where it ends,
yes,
where they kill Brent.
All the violent scenes,
yeah.
and they kill Brent at the end, yes.
Yeah, I just watched that the other night. Well, Phyllis and
Brent,
I watched that.
Not Brent.
Yeah.
We're not killing Brent.
No, Brent was drunk and walking into walls at... Chiller.
That's right. It's Chiller, too.
But, no, we watched that the other night, and I don't think Phyllis had ever seen it. So we went back, and I just played that ending again for the theatrical cut, where it ends, you know, we'll wait, and, you know, the happier ending.
Right. Right.
But I tell you, you know, we'll go into that. Let's go.
All the way back.
Yeah, let's start kind of at the beginning. And, well, first off, let's put it this way. What's your favorite out of the five?
Oh, Planet.
Planet. Okay, Planet aside, because that one stands on its own.
Planet aside, this was kind of funny because growing up, I always liked Conquest. And
yeah.
No one did. No one else did. I remember I really liked Conquest.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone liked Beneath, which... now, in retrospect, is not that great of a movie. Has great characters in some cases, but and then Battle, everyone liked because they just wanted to see people fight.
Yeah.
And you had mutants again. So
and Paul Williams.
Yeah, and Paul Williams. and everyone liked that. So, but Conquest was this one in the middle that a lot of people just didn't like because of the setting, and you didn't have Cornelius and Zira and... you didn't have gorillas really in the way gorillas and orangutans.
Yeah, they barely had any orangutans at all.
Yeah, so you know, I just always thought it was an interesting movie, and I think that's why I like, you know, Rise and Dawn so much, that they are sort of a riff on Battle and Conquest.
Yeah,
and a very. You know, very well done. Tip of the hat to those movies. So,
well, I think I've got I find a new appreciation maybe for Conquest. Watching it again, I think I like it better than I did. I never disliked it, but it wasn't like you say, like most people, it wasn't my top after Planet. But watching it again the other night, and you know, man, just Roddy's performance in it. I mean, especially when he finds out that Armando is dead.
Yes. Well, it's got such a great cast for those of us that just love 70s actors anyway.
Oh, God, but, yes. Oh, man, even Gordon Jump.
Gordon Jump, that's right.
For me, I get...
Now here's...
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, for me, I want to say it was probably Battle, and I don't know why. I mean, maybe because Paul Williams was in it, and...
and Sonny from Moving On.
Yeah, you know, and Sonny from Moving On. Couldn't even say Sheriff Lobo, could you?
No, because he was Sonny first.
Yeah.
And then he was the sheriff from Night Stalker, you know? So, you know.
That's right. Oh, crap, man. Oh, geez. I don't know.
Old Jack, you watch yourself.
But we'll get, and you know, another thing, we'll get into Roddy's makeup changing throughout the series, too.
That's right.
And pick our favorite of that as we go. But go ahead. What were you getting ready to say?
I was going to ask. I don't think I've ever, of all the things we've talked about, Planet Apes, I don't think I've ever asked you, do you remember the first time you ever saw it?
You know, I was thinking about that today, actually. I was trying to remember and figuring. I was going to ask you that.
Yeah, neither of us saw it in the theater.
No. I remember. I want to say the first time that I consciously can remember seeing an Apes film. Was one of those, like, you know, the CBS late movie they used to run at like 10 or 11 o'clock at night. Or maybe it was 9 o'clock at night, whatever, something like that. But it was called the CBS, I want to say late movie, or it was just CBS movie, after all the primetime TV shows were going
off. Yeah, that was the one I think at 10.
Yeah, and I remember seeing, I want to say it was Escape. I had seen one of the other ones or two before this because I was familiar with it and excited that it was coming on. But that's my first conscious memory of seeing Apes, like on, you know, on TV or whatever, was a CBS late movie, and Escape was coming on. And I watched, I don't remember everything about it, but I remember some of the scenes stand out in my head that I can almost see myself watching it, you know what I mean, as a kid. And I want to say I might have even been at my grandparents' house or something. Other than that, I mean, you know, then just whenever it would come on, like, they used to have something right here called the 6:30 movie on one of the network channels, you know, like dinner time movie in the afternoons there, right early evening. And usually every day it was just some movie, but once or twice a year they would do Monster Week, and you'd either have, you know, some B pictures, or you'd have Godzilla Week, or, and once in a while they would do Apes Week, and you'd get
Apes Week. Yep.
Each day you get a different Apes movie. So I remember that too. How about you?
And this is the story that I wrote in that Chiller Theater.
Oh yeah.
Issue, and that was, I have very fond memories of that CBS Friday night movie.
Yeah,
and that was the one where the film reel rolled out there.
Yep, you know? I remember. And that's the one I'm talking about. I think I remember that well.
And my parents were playing cards in the next room with Company and stuff, mm-hmm. and it came on, and I'd seen the ads, I'd been waiting and waiting and waiting for it. So it finally comes on. I just mesmerized.
Oh, yeah.
Every commercial break, I would run in and try to tell them that they should come in. They need to come in and see this. You would not believe what that... So,
that's awesome.
And then from that on, I was hooked. And then when we get into the merchandising, I'll tell you something.
Oh, yeah.
I remember that so well. And the thing that stood out, I think, the most, obviously the makeup.
Oh, yeah.
And that first moment when during the hunt when the gorillas turned.
Yeah.
But the music, it was such an odd score.
Uh-huh.
You know, at the time, I just never heard anything like that.
Well, you know, I was thinking about that, too, the music. Of course, the first movie is Gold. You know, the
Goldsmith.
Goldsmith, that's right. Goldsmith scores gold. And I don't remember Beneath having any memorable, really, music, but Escape, I love the music in Escape.
I love it, yeah. It's,
especially
it's
that
so goofy,
the beginning, that but, beginning where they're taking the apes to the zoo, you know, getting them off the beach.
That's right.
It's just, I don't know, it's cool, though. It sounds like, it's really like they're moving. It's like traveling music, you know?
Yeah.
But that was a good
score.
Yeah.
I can't remember, did Goldsmith do, no, he didn't do three.
I don't think so.
I can't remember who did right off the bat. Rosenman, I think, did too.
Yeah.
Leonard Rosenman did Beneath.
I don't...
And the others were totally unforgettable.
Yeah, Battle.
Everything from then on.
From what I remember, the beginning of Battle.
Battle or Conquest.
Yeah, it's just nothing remarkable, nothing notable about the music in that. But let's go back to the first movie. I mean, like I said, we're not going to give a synopsis of each movie, but, you know, we got to talk about it. And the thing about these movies... On the surface, you know, they're just fun action, sci-fi action movies. And a lot of people don't really feel the weight of them and what they're, you know, the themes in them and all. Until you sit down and you really watch it or somebody tells you about it, like we're getting ready to. But,
I guess, you know, we never got the advantage of watching these things as adults first. And, you know, there's a ludicrous point. You know, the whole idea of apes talking is rather ludicrous. And you could see where some people instantly dismissed it for that reason. They just,
well,
you know, I don't want to bother with that.
Any sci-fi, then, people without imagination, just, you know.
Exactly. And then all the social commentary that's worked in there, both the ones that are pointed and then the ones that are there for a little gag.
Uh-huh.
But it's such a well-rounded movie in that it's got that, it's got its adventure and action, like you said. It's got a sense of humor.
Yeah.
A little bit of a dark humor in it. And then it's just got one hell of an ending.
Oh, yeah. Well so, you know.
Which is the other thing, when you first watched it as a kid, you go, oh, my God.
One of the greatest endings in cinematic history.
Endings of all time, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, I'm not even saying that ironically or saying it as a, you know, just a fan of the movie. It literally is one of the most jaw-dropping endings in, you know, in cinema.
Oh, I think it is. And it's just, you know, the movies have been diluted, one, by themselves, and then two, just by pop culture.
Oh, yeah.
But you have to watch the first movie by itself.
Oh, yeah.
You're not thinking of any sequels, just as a one-shot almost, to really, really appreciate it. And then there's just wonderfully drawn characters. I mean,
I mean, it's got a lot of weight
Dr.
to it.
Dr. Zaius, to this date, is just one of my all-time favorite film characters.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, he's...
You know, because he's a villain, but he's not.
But in his mind, he's just trying to preserve the status quo.
That's right. And he does what he has to do, and he's fully aware of this thing that he has to do, and he doesn't want to do it, you know, because there's a respect there between him and Taylor, as, you know, at the same time that there's total disgust.
Yeah. So,
but it's not disgust for him as a person, it's disgust for a species.
Yeah.
That he feels.
And that he showed
ruined
up.
Ruined all this.
It's like, oh, things were great. Why did you have to show up? And it's like he knew everything that Taylor told him was true, but he
and
didn't.
That's the uncomfortable.
Yeah. Now he's confronted with it.
Yeah.
Man. Yeah.
And
then
knowing that there's no way that this can get out and people know, you know, when people start to question, we're going to have a breakdown of our society, and that can't happen.
And it's already a little not volatile, but a little uneasy between the classes, with the soldiers want to kind of take over in a way. They just want to make war on the humans and the mutants and everything and run everything. But the orangutans really run everything. They're the bureaucrats and the
right.
And everything.
You have the scientists.
And the scientists, the chimpanzees, they just want to learn stuff. You know, that's all. They just want to find out how the humans work, find out how this works, and they want to, you know, just keep the peace and not worry about all that other stuff.
And you have two groups that really are about keeping the status quo and not changing, and one that wants to question everything.
Yeah.
And I think that's the genius of the movie is these classes of the eight, that it's not just one big society. And I think, not that we really want to talk about the abomination known as the Tim Burton Apes Project. But
I'm sorry, you're breaking up here. I can't hear you.
Exactly. But that was one of the problems.
Look,
with
static.
Them is, with that film, I thought is there was no division of people.
Well, it was just it was a mess.
For the first movie, it almost speaks of like races and the problems between races.
Oh yeah,
as if the apes were.
Oh,
it definitely
was kind of mirroring what was going on in real life in a lot of ways between the civil rights struggle at the time through the late 60s and the early 70s. And then the classes between the working class and the elite rich, and then the poor, you know, and they weren't really thrown it in your face that's what they were doing. It came out in the telling of the story. The only way that was really blatant was that all the gorillas wore one outfit, all the orangutans wore another, and all the, you know, chimps wore another. And, you know, I don't know why they made that choice, if it was consciously to, okay, this class wears this, or if it was just easier for the costumers, if it was something that simple, or...
No, I think they had decided, there were variations of the costumes. If you look close with the chimps, they have the most variation in the costumes. Then the gorillas have a couple variations.
Yeah. Well, the orangutans do have variation. I mean, you look in the courtroom scene.
Right. They have their different...
Yeah, Dr. Honorius.
Showing who, with the glyphs and everything.
Yeah. The one has them all the way down.
Basically, the style is basically the same, where chimps had a difference, you know, what was female, what was male.
Uh-huh.
But you never see any female orangutan.
Or gorillas,
for that matter.
That is, you know, I never really gave that much thought before, but you're right. You don't see any female gorillas or orangutans.
You see a child... gorilla, and you see a child chimp.
Yeah.
But beyond that, but the first movie has a lot of different costumes, but I think they wanted the audience to very quickly see these are the divisions, and this is why it's important. This is who holds certain powers, and it's a nice visual shortcut.
Oh, yeah.
And the costumes are just beautiful.
Oh, they're great.
But
I mean,
they were nominated for an Oscar, so.
Yeah, they're fantastic costumes. If you get the Blu-ray and the extras on Battle, they show some of the actual costumes up close. Like the guy's holding Virgil's jacket, and that's where he says the shirt's a chimpanzee shirt, and he's got the actual Ursus top. So you get a nice oh yeah. Are you wetting them?
Yeah.
You get a nice crisp up close look of those. It's oh man. Yeah, they still look beautiful today.
And everyone always talks about the makeup.
Yeah.
Of course, there's certain things. There's the makeup, and then there's, like, the design of the ship and things like that. But, you know, you hardly ever really hear anyone talk about the genius of the design of the costumes. And that's unfortunate, you know? Yeah. I mean, everyone goes gaga over the makeup, which deservedly so.
Well, we'll go that way. We'll go there in a minute.
Yeah.
The costumes, though, you know, if you look at some of the sketches, the costume sketches of proposed ideas, well, thank God they didn't go with some of those. And what they settled on is really unique and imaginative and different from, you know, other science fiction stuff that was out at the time, whereas some of the earlier sketches just looked kind of blah, you know, nothing is the visual impact is what they settled on finally.
Right. And then they are able to give you hints of what's underneath the costumes with a character like Julius.
Uh-huh.
Who actually has two different costumes in the movie.
He's got the sleeveless one,
and then he has the one with the sleeves. But to see the hair, and you really see him as an animal more.
Yeah.
That's so, because, you know, the makeup makes them neither ape nor man. It's kind of in the middle, but that was wise because they don't hide the actor's ability to give a performance, which it had to do. I mean,
and perform, and they do.
That's right. So, and the other thing, okay, we're going to talk about the apes. We've joked about Roddy and some of the other characters, and we have left Chuck in the dust.
Well, the first movie is Chuck's movie, man. I mean,
I always thought the genius of the movie was to take a person that is disgusted by humanity and a person that would have no problem leaving the Earth.
And which he does.
Yeah.
And his reasoning is there's got to be something better, you know, or.
That's right. But for this mission, that there's probably no hope of ever getting back.
Yeah.
And he's okay with that. And then he ends up having to be the spokesperson for our race, the person that doesn't really have the faith to defend it, but he has to come to defend it.
Yeah.
And he's a great 60s sort of anti-hero, and it needed someone that could own every frame he's in.
Oh, yeah.
And bigger than life, somewhat bigger than life, someone you think would survive all this.
Yeah.
At that time.
Well, yeah, you know, getting Chuck to for the part, of course, he lobbied for the movie to get made, but like you said, it was genius getting him because he gave the movie the weight.
The weight of it. A lot of people, you know, people joke him for his somewhat, you know, he's always been hit for not being the most emotive actor in the world. And he, you know, he is somewhat limited, but I think he's perfect at this.
Oh, yeah. You couldn't have gotten anybody better that was around at the time, I don't think. They would have had the credibility or given the role the credibility that he does.
Right.
I mean, you're talking, you know, because he's come from stage and screen and TV and, you know, and he's done a little bit of everything by the time Apes had come around. You know, well known for the big biblical dramas and these big, huge role, these larger-than-life characters. And then he does this little low-budget sci-fi film and just explodes out of it. I mean, it makes the movie, I mean, not just Chuck. I mean, everybody in it, you know, just gave an incredible, all the principals anyway, just gave amazing performances through the makeup and all. But Chuck, getting it a lot different than getting somebody else, you know, like who else around at the time.
And now we have to, for people listening that don't understand why we call him Chuck.
Because we can.
As if our good buddy Chuck was in the movie.
Because saying Charlton Heston every time it takes too long. But
yeah.
But we've shaken hands with the man on more than one occasion. That's why we call him Chuck.
That is right. That is right.
We had the good fortune to meet him on at least three or four occasions, I want to say, when he
three or four, yeah.
Somehow, you know, by luck came through town, and it was an amazing experience to shake hands with Taylor and Moses.
Well, and the best thing about it was we had our vision of what he would be like.
And
he did not disappoint us. He was every bit, even at his age then, he was every bit as big.
Yeah, larger than life, classy. And
very classy. I mean, he was that epitome of old Hollywood that we wanted to get to be in the presence of.
Oh, yeah. And
just gracious.
You know, and the thing about what I've always heard people say, and even Joe Knutt said this, you know, when we met him in Waynesburg that Chuck was the kind of guy that it didn't matter if you were the star of the picture, the director, the grip, or the janitor. He talked to everybody the exact same way.
Yeah.
He treated everybody like the same as he would treat the janitor the same as he would treat like the producer. You know, and didn't matter who you were, if he was talking to you, he was talking to you. And that's the way he came across when we met him.
That's right.
You know?
And then we had the good fortune of, I mean, I know I've had the good fortune to meet a few other people. I met Roddy.
Yeah, well, we both did.
Same way.
Yeah, we
that's
both
right.
did that night.
We both the same time
that
night.
And he was gracious as hell. You could tell he was tired after that play.
Well, he did two shows that day.
Yeah, but he stayed out there.
He was filling makeup.
And made sure everybody got an autograph, everybody got a picture, and anybody was talking to him. You know, he made sure he talked to every, you know. He was great. It was fantastic. And he old Hollywood, too.
Yeah, so, I mean, and those, you know, those people being in the movie, they added all their little bits of personality. Cornelius comes across, even though it's a small part, you know, when you watch the movie and you really watch it, you realize it's not that big of a part. Zira's is much bigger.
Yeah.
Zira's part is considerably bigger.
Oh, yeah.
And then Zaius is bigger than,
and, you know,
than those.
Who would have thought that Samantha's father from Bewitched could carry that heavy a role as Zaius and just make you, you know, believe it.
And it's and all the little things that he does.
Oh yeah.
With it. You know, just his delivery and everything that he never comes across as just a big heavy, even though he occupies that position in the movie, so to speak. He is the villain, but he never comes across as just a heavy.
No, he completely.
What's great about it.
Yeah, it's like he was completely comfortable with that the character and knew exactly who he was as the character, you know, the whole time, and was in complete control of whatever scene he was in as Zaius. I mean, Zaius was in complete control, you know.
Yeah, and Zaius is just such an interesting character. I just among all the characters. Cornelius tends to be, you know, he's the more one dimensional character of the lot, and Zira a little more well rounded.
Yeah,
her feistiness comes through.
Oh yeah, Kim Hunter was amazing as Zira.
And then Zaius is just, you know, I think one of my favorite scenes is the where he brings Taylor in privately just to talk to him.
Uh huh. Oh yeah, yeah. That little exchange between them there.
And that's just a great little scene. It's so well done with the two, and it's so well written. And that's where you see that there's a respect there, but I cannot let you live.
Yeah.
Kind of an attitude that you have to understand you cannot exist in this world.
Yeah.
And then even at the end, when he destroys the cave, it's the same thing. He says, look, I don't like what I'm about to do, but this is the way it's got to be.
Yeah. You know, my favorite thing about their performances, of course, you know, what they've got to work with is mainly their eyes, you know? I mean, they got as much as their face showing through the makeup as they could, but it's mainly their eyes do most of their emoting and everything. You know, Kim Hunter was just fantastic with that, with Zira and the different things, like the first time Taylor speaks and her eyes, and she like almost, you can almost see her go, and her eyes get huge and she's smiling like that's what she's been looking for her whole life. You know, it just comes across right there. And Roddy, just everything he did with, anytime he'd go,
Yeah.
You know, just that little bit of noise and way he'd wrinkle his brow or whatever. It's, you know, it spoke volumes of what his character was thinking at the time. But my favorite Zaius moment, though, is not the exchange between Taylor is great, but my favorite Zaius moment is in Beneath when the Ursus is giving his speech. And
no,
Zaius is like
not
falling asleep. And then they start clapping and Zaius like, oh yeah.
I think that's why I always had a problem with Beneath, is because it really took a dump on the Zaius character.
Well, yeah. But you know, that shows that Zaius is like, you know, he's like, yeah, just go ahead, say your stuff. I know, yeah, whatever. I got, yeah. And he's like, oh, okay. But he doesn't say anything, but it's just the way his eyes kind of flutter and he tilts his head, like, you know, it says everything to what he's thinking at that moment, you know.
But you know, you imagine what could Beneath have been had Zaius been a much stronger character and been the character he was in Planet.
Oh, yeah.
Alongside of Ursus and that power struggle. But also, I always thought Ursus is not the the smartest guy on the face of the earth. That
no.
It would have been better if it was very obvious that Zayas's position was, okay, I'm going to let you play your game, all right?
Uh-huh.
But I'm 10 times smarter than you, so you're not going to know that I'm playing you, okay? I'm the puppet master here. I'm pulling the strings.
Yeah. But, unfortunately, Brent got a lot of time.
Yeah, unfortunately. And Nova. Nova got more time than she needed.
And do those scenes drag or what?
They do. They're not handled well by the director.
No.
So that's part of it. Beneath is so shoddily shot.
Well, let's face it too now.
And edited, and it's too, it's a short movie. It's like Battle. They're very quick movies.
Yeah.
Planet and Conquest are the longest movies.
Yeah, because Planet's, two and some change, right?
Yeah, and Conquest almost comes to two.
Yeah.
Where I think Beneath is like 87 minutes, like that.
Yeah.
It's very quick.
And let's face it, Franciscus just does not have the screen presence or charisma that Chuck does.
No, and even when Chuck comes on, he's phoning it in. It's a paycheck by that time. He has a natural charisma.
But he still lights up the screen, though, when he's on.
Yeah. And then you don't have Roddy.
No, oh, God, no. And what's his name doing Cornelius in that? I can never remember the guy's name.
David Watson.
He imitates Roddy's voice pretty good at some points, but he cannot do the walk, the move.
He can't do the walk or he doesn't do any of the subtleties of the facial movements and everything.
Yeah.
But you do get that wonderful line. They will torture you and kill you in that order.
Oh, I thought you were going to go, and I shall hit her again.
Well, I have no violence. Don't get me started. I already watched the movie.
Man. Okay, now we're talking about the makeup. We got to go into that a little bit.
Okay.
All the background apes. Now, you can see on some of them, it's obvious that they reuse Roddy's appliance on some of them.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess Kim's on some of them. But then you get the other ones where they did make some extra appliances. So they do, each of them do look, some of them look unique. But then you get especially the gorillas or the orangutans where they have those masks. And it's more noticeable in Beneath than it is in any of the other ones, I think.
Well,
where
the
top lips curl in. Like they made it with a thinner rubber or something, and it can't hold its shape. Oh God! It looks like they're all retarded apes. They've got sent.
Well, but the sculpt is like that for whatever reason, and I don't know why the mask is so different of a sculpt than the appliances. But when you look at the behind the scenes pictures where they're painting those over the head masks. It's just a totally different.
But some of them aren't, because when you get to Conquest, I was watching some of the behind the scenes and some of the actors putting those masks on, they look great.
Now some of the gorilla, there were different types. There were some gorilla masks that are a little better.
Yeah.
And then there's the far background ones, which are those ones with the curled lip.
Oh God, those are awful.
And I saw an article one time about some of the appliances that, like, they had the Roddy ones that they would reuse. There's a James Daly orangutan, who's Honorius, that was used a lot for the orangutan, and that's all through the movies.
They
recycle whatever.
Oh yeah, and they recycle the costumes through every movie too. So.
Oh yeah. Oh gosh, yeah.
Yeah.
But one of the things I noticed about the makeup, you were talking about how Roddy's changed.
Yeah.
Cornelius has that great part in his hair, the way his hair splits apart.
In the first movie.
In the first movie.
Yeah.
From Beneath on, it's slicked back. It's a very quick, everything about the makeups begins to lose the finesse of the first movie.
Yeah. What?
The softness of it.
Also, Cornelius, besides the hair on top, the hair underneath the chin changes. In the first movie, it kind of goes to a point, and it's shorter. And then I can't remember Beneath, but when you get to Escape, it's kind of more full and almost more Caesar-like.
Yes, and then from that point on, and then, of course, when it gets to Galen, it's this big, but it's very slick and sprayed because it was easier to keep it up.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
For continuity,
And of course, when we get to Galen, it's a completely different appliance.
Right.
For the TV show, is it like a narrower snout? From what I remember, I haven't seen that in quite a while, but it just didn't look as good to me.
No. Shooting it for TV, and in the bright lights, and it never looked real either. And there are shots in battle that are the same way. It never has the softness that the first movie did.
Yeah. Now see, I need to go back and watch some of the TV show, to really compare. I haven't been able to see any of that in quite a while. But
you're not missing a whole lot.
you know,
that is something I have watched. Every so often, I'll pull one out and watch it. And this is one of the bad things about getting older and returning to this stuff. I remember when the TV show came on.
Oh.
I was just glued to the set.
Oh, I remember if we were out, I had to be home.
Every episode.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
Feeling that it wasn't great, but
it was Apes, you know, and it was on TV every week,
and I loved it. And I remember when they announced the show that it was getting canceled, and they had another show already ready to take its place on Friday nights. And now you talk about, I can't remember which day is trash day, but I remember the name of the show that supplanted Apes in my childhood. And it was called Khan. And it was about an Asian detective.
Oh, I remember that.
A bigger guy, was kind of, you know, not quite canon size.
Yeah.
But bald headed, kind of like, you know, some poor man's Harold Sakata that they hired.
Yeah. Wow.
And, but he was called, interestingly enough, Khan. You know? I'm sure at some point, you know, when I saw that they announced it, actually, you know, Khan! and I was so disappointed. And it wasn't that good, though.
Yeah,
I rewatched it again, and the shortcomings really are, it's like watching the Night Stalker TV show. The budget, the time limit, you know, you have to get the story told in this amount of time. And it's, every episode is basically The Fugitive.
Oh, well, yeah. Oh, God. Can we count the TV shows that were just clones of The Fugitive?
Exactly. Many shows. But they weren't imaginative about how to work that, I don't think, as well as they could have.
No, it was just cashing in on the wave of popularity.
There's some good episodes that hint at what that show could have been.
Well, yeah, and you know, the fun thing is, well, okay, let's talk real quick about the actors on there. You got Roddy, of course, is what made it.
Right.
Made it really watchable. But Mark Leonard is Urko. I mean, and Mark Leonard, of course, from, you know, Sarak from Star Trek. I mean, you know, come on.
Yep.
And Booth Coleman, Zayas.
Booth Coleman?
Yeah, you know, wasn't bad.
Zayas on the TV show is a very good character, believe it or not. It's different. It's not the same Zayas.
No,
You know, it's not supposed to be, but I always imagine watching the show and Zayas was a surname and it would just be passed down. And this was just their job to be a defender of the faith, like this family line. This was their job, was to do this. And then it was just, all the truth was passed down through this family of Zayas.
Yeah.
And I think entirely too much of this stuff.
Oh, no, we haven't even scratched the surface on that. Wait till we get to talking about the ship.
He's a good character. He's a good character. The Urko character is unfortunately modeled after Ursus.
Yeah.
And Aldo, and very much one dimensional, unfortunately.
Yeah. Booth's, Coleman's makeup was kind of cool, though. Didn't he have those little wisps of white in with the blonde?
Yeah, and the white, and the way his beard came down in a point. It's a more stylized version of the Maurice Evans makeup, but it's a nice look.
Game is unique.
And the costumes were reused.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I'm sure Roddy and Booth Coleman got new costumes.
Oh, well, yeah, Galen's was different.
And Mark Leonard's was
Aldo's.
Original, except for the Aldo piece is the Ursus piece.
Yeah, but it's just the collar, though, not the rest of the shirt.
The collar. And then basically, you know, it's the same gorilla vest and belt. But, well, that's what's different. He wears a belt.
Oh, that's right. And, you know,
a belt around his waist rather than a bandolier.
talking about the costumes, the gorilla costumes, one of the things that the close-ups had those nice vest and the embossed or the stitched lines across them and all that, and even right. on the gloves. And a lot of the background ones further back, they were just painted on. The lines were painted on, and it was a vinyl, not a leather.
Well, you know, Rob has one of the background gorillas, our friend Rob Withrow, Withrow collection.
Oh, God, yes.
Has a background. He also has part of an original.
Oh, yeah.
It's a full display made up of different costume pieces
yeah.
through the movies. But the gloves are the real gloves. The jacket is the real. So that's really interesting to see the craftsmanship.
Oh, yeah. When you see that stuff jacket, up close, it's
the real
great.
Leather jacket. And the bandolier, what the bandolier was and what the boots were. Really? I mean,
now, if you ever get a chance to see, do you remember, follow me here. It's going to seem like I'm going way off for a second, though.
Us go way off? Are you kidding me?
You remember the Richard Pryor show from the 70s? It was only on maybe a season. There was
they do the Star Wars thing.
They do a Star Wars thing, like it's in the Cantina Bar at Star Wars, and they're like off-the-shelf mask of aliens and stuff, I think.
Right.
But a lot of them wearing
the apes
costumes, from the TV show.
Well, where else do the costumes show up? You get and one of the spacesuits from Escape is in the cantina in Star Wars.
Yeah, that's right.
And where else did I see?
Hey, there's another thing, okay? Let's go back. Let's talk about the ship.
Okay.
Now, where did they get those spacesuits that the apes are wearing? Didn't the astronauts get off the ship in their suits?
They didn't have suits. Well, that was emergency wear in the back. They found that in the closet.
That was their pressure suits. Okay, I'll give them that. I'll let it slide. But
they didn't have time to go get the suits, you know, because they were in the water. Yeah. They didn't need them.
We have always joked on the ship, especially Brent's ship, you know, which was just called Brent's ship, I think. Taylor's was the Icarus, but Brent's was just Brent's ship.
Well, but it wasn't. Now, here's the thing. It was never in production referred to as the Icarus. That was a fan
thing
that picked up later.
That's right, because in the movies, they just call it Taylor's ship.
They just call it the Ansa craft.
Yeah. But you only see it.
It never has a name, and that was developed later, you know, through fandom.
Yeah. When they're inside it, when Taylor's inside it in the first movie, it's the windows. Okay, the nose cone and the windows thing is long, and then there's the windows. And then the space behind that is rather, because he walks away from the cockpit, you know, back towards where they're in their you know, sleep chambers. And there's still a little more ship. Okay, when we see it again, it's in the water and just the nose cone sticking out. Okay, you know, it's underwater. The next time we see the ship again, we see Brent's ship, which is really was Taylor's ship, the actual prop.
Right. Yeah, that's the same ship with all the gantry.
Yeah, but it's cut off right, like not even, 5 feet behind the window where they would sit to pilot it. There's nothing after that. It's just a rounded bottom, and then there's, you know, wreckage of like girders and stuff.
Well, one of the things, you know, I've seen pictures, you know, of them on the interior set of the ship. I've never seen like a full shot of the, you know, from like the cockpit back. So you see actually the interior shot of how big that set was.
Yeah.
I've always wished I could see, you know, I would love to see that or see the schematics of the interior set. You kind of believe that the ship is longer because of the way it's sitting in the water. I always thought it was longer. But,
Know it is because he's, you know, like I said, at the beginning when he goes to sleep, he walks a good distance from the chair to where they're laying in their bunks. So you know it's longer.
You know there's space back there for the engines and everything.
And past that, but when Brent's ship is laying there, there's no engines. There's no space for sleep chambers. It's just like maybe a couple of feet behind where the window is, and it ends.
Right.
The ship just ends bluntly, and there's nothing there. So Brent didn't get a chance, didn't get to sleep on his journey, huh?
No, he didn't have the beds.
He's just got the landing gear, that's all.
Well, he drug the gantry into space, apparently.
You know, I saw a really cool blueprint that somebody had drawn up about what the ship looked like before it took off. And a lot of that stuff is like a landing gear. It's supposed to be like in this drawing anyway, was like landing gear.
Yeah, there's a guy that did a full 3D animation of the ship, which is really cool. That's online, and they show all that. Now, of course, when Escape rolls around, they use that same prop without the back, without any detail in the engines or anything.
Yeah, how did it fly? How did it get off the...
there's so many.
There's no engines.
How did they get the ship out of the water? How did they seal up the escape hatch that was blown off an explosive
Here's how they got it out of the water.
If you look close in Planet, one of the windows blows out.
Yeah.
So, and then how they get the water out of it, how they repair it, they're in their spacesuits. So they go through the time curve, not through... having to sleep at all, which may explain Brent's situation. So some of the people think that they don't actually return in Taylor's ship.
Yeah, it's Brent's ship.
It's Brent's ship because it's relatively undamaged.
Yeah, but how did they get, and they wouldn't know. I mean, Dr. Milo wouldn't have known.
No, it could be on an autopilot system and they accidentally activate it.
But what thrusts it off the planet?
The explosion of the planet. They're just sitting there waiting
they got
for
catapulted.
Their demise. And, man, the thing blows up, and next thing they know, they got blown up into the atmosphere.
Okay. That's a fun theory, but I got to blow that out of the water. Because Zero says when they inject her with the Grape Juice Plus, she says through the window of the spaceship after they were in space, they saw the Earth blow up.
Well, yeah, that was the final explosion. The first little blast,
that just shot the spaceship.
That was like the first wave just shot it out. And
okay.
Come on. Look, they have chairs, There's a third chair in there.
Yeah, I'm with
you. For Milo.
I'll go with that.
Okay. Hey, by the time you get to the TV show, right behind the chairs is computers.
Yeah.
There's nothing back there.
Yeah, we only talk about that ship. I mean, yeah, they walk in the thing and boom, there's chairs and computers. It's not even as big as the Galileo 7.
Well, it's interesting to note about these movies is there was never an intent to make a series of movies.
No.
Every movie was treated like that was the last one.
Yeah.
And the great thing about that is a series of films constructed with the most downer endings possible.
Oh, you're not kidding.
For what is marketed towards kids and a younger audience. I mean, the first movie, what a hopeless situation. You're screwed. You're stuck here. Your society's gone.
Yeah.
All right.
Second you were the movie, last of your kind. That's it.
Second movie, let's blow the whole damn planet up and everybody with it.
Yeah.
Third movie, let's shoot in cold blood, your two heroes.
and their child. And their baby infant.
And their baby. So everyone dies at the end of that, pretty much. Conquest ends in a bloody battle.
Yeah. Where the human race has fallen.
Yeah, with the human race pretty much shot to hell. And then battle ends with this very, very strong indication that nothing's going to work. So,
well, I don't know. Battle's the most hopeful of any of them for the ending.
It is, but you get that hint, where the two kids are fighting, that where it's going. It's inevitable for them to connect the loop. The apes are going to take over.
Well, I saw that, and I heard somebody else say something about that, one of the behind the scenes things, and I didn't get that out of that. The two kids playing. That was just two kids getting along and playing like kids do. Like they finally accepted them as equals because, he pulls the pigtails and she pushes that little ape down and that's it. They don't rough and tumble. They're just,
I always,
they're just teasing each other like kids do.
That was the hint that's the beginning. It was just that little bit. That's what I always thought.
Well, that may have what they've been going for because, like I said, somebody else said that in one of those behind the scenes documentary things, but it didn't hit me that way. It hit me the other way, like, oh, they're finally getting along and not taking, if he pushes them down, they didn't take it personal and want to shoot them.
Right.
You know?
Battle's a, you know, we've kind of talked about all the other movies. Battle is a movie, I think it's considered the worst because, one, the budget shows horribly, but the I think it was just mishandled. It's got really good ideas,
yeah,
but it was just mishandled.
Well, and like you said earlier, about, you know, each one so short, where the first one was over 2 hours long, and Conquest was close to, almost 2 hours? But Battle and Escape and Beneath were all not even an hour and a half, like almost an hour and a half. And, you know, it's a lot of information, a lot of story to cram into that. You can't afford to, you know, have any subtleties in it like in the first movie.
Oh, yeah. Well, and Battle, Battle has, you know, let's talk about the pluses of Battle. New characters.
Yeah.
Okay, Virgil is a super character.
Oh, yeah.
Aldo, the typical gorilla character. I mean, you know, nothing great there. You know, the relationship with Caesar and his son Cornelius and Lisa and their family and then what happens.
Uh-huh.
I've always liked that part.
Yeah.
And that Caesar has to resort to an act of violence.
Yeah. Where it's interesting because Roddy, the character he has played up till then, his Cornelius character was, super pacifist.
Right.
Until he flipped the tray. You know, somebody had to insult his wife, and that's all he could take. And he flips the tray and escape and accidentally kills the guy. But he feels incredible remorse for it.
Right.
But then you get to Caesar where he, you know, after Armando's, he sees that way apes are treated as slaves, and after Armando's killed, then Caesar gets serious and wants to revolt and, you know, get back at the humans. And then you get him in Battle where he has to actually fight, take on another ape.
Right.
And he's every bit as formidable as a gorilla, who we're taught throughout the series that they are the warlike class.
Right.
That's really interesting. Hey, here's another one. I don't know if I don't think we've ever talked about this, but have you noticed that a lot of the biblical references in the movies, or as far as the stories are kind of real, parallel a lot of biblical stories? In Escape, it's like Haslein, it's like Herod hunting down the Christ child, whereas baby Milo is the future of the ape race, the savior of the ape race. And then in Battle, it's Cain and Abel, where ape kills ape.
Right.
You know, ape shall never kill ape. You know, human, you know
right.
Thou shalt not kill. You know, it's the same thing, but then he has to.
Right. Well, the
pretty heavy stuff.
And you know about this, that the one of the ideas that was there originally, and I remember this is in the Marvel comic adaptation.
Oh, yeah.
Battle,
uh-huh.
And that is when Caesar goes to the ancient city to see the tapes of his mother and father. Upon coming back, he has radiation poisoning. And
yeah.
He starts to lose his hair. So in effect, you know, the other apes, and Aldo sees a chance to really get at him as becoming more human, not just...
Okay, now let's reiterate. Let's clarify, though. That was not in the film.
No, that's not in the film. That was in an early draft of the script.
An early draft of the script, okay.
He would start losing his hair. So when Marvel Comics did the adaptation, they used that version of the script, which is interesting because the movie had already come out.
Yeah, yeah.
But they used that version of the script, and it has those passages in there where Aldo confronts him about, you know, him losing his hair.
Oh, that's awesome. I need to go check that out. I don't think I've ever
read
that.
That would have been a really cool idea. The other is that, you know, there are scenes that were cut out of Battle, one where Culp leaves the control of the bomb to, what's her name, Albania?
Uh-huh.
Francie Newman. Yeah, and that's not in the final cut of the movie.
No, you don't see anything about that. In fact, you don't even know they have a bomb, do you?
You don't.
Yeah.
And see, I think that's pretty important because that lays the groundwork for what happens in Beneath.
Yeah.
They had it. It was there all the time. But the problem with that is Battle happens in the West Coast.
Yeah.
Which is where the TV show happens, and the first two happen on the East Coast. So that doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah. But, you know, that's another interesting thing. I think in some of the later comics they did in the 80s or the 90s, where they something that we never really thought of, or they never really said in the movies, but how there's different pockets of ape cultures in different parts of the country that we never saw. We just really saw the ones that lived in like the adobe or the cave like houses.
Right.
You know, and there's different different degrees of advancement in culture depending on where they were and all that. Like the
and
book.
Different relationships with the humans.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the TV show, there were places where, you know, the apes and the humans got along.
Yeah.
That was something neat with the TV show. And there were people that, you know, they were trying to come to some sort of understanding, and then,
before
some ideas there.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, before we get into that, and then we're gonna have to talk about the how the timeline in the movie just doesn't really work in the movies, especially between Conquest and Battle.
Oh, that compressed time.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and stop for now for this particular episode and make this at least a two-parter, because we're already over an hour here before Phyllis edits
that was
it.
Quick.
I told you we're going to talk for a week or two on this. but let's go ahead and stop. This is a pretty good point, and we can pick back up with the timeline and the relationship between the show and all on the next episode. So we'll just stop here, and I'll say, hey, if you listen to this episode and you liked it or any of the others, drop us a line at phantasmoad@gmail.com or on the Facebook page, Phantasmo After Dark, and, you know, tell us if you like it, if you don't like it, to shut the hell up, or if some of this other stuff you'd like to hear us do a podcast on, do that. And, of course, as always, I'll be posting a bunch of pictures and trailers and stuff when the episode goes up live, so check out the Facebook page. And tune into the next episode where we're going to continue. We're going to return to the Planet of the Apes in the next episode.
Oh, you stole my line! Damn you! Damn you all to hell!
Again, Clayton and I have known each other for well over 20 years, and we have the tendency once in a while to finish each other's lines and sentences and things. So. But again, you know, I'm going to say we're going to keep recording here in a minute and to go on to the next episode, but we're going to stop this here. So I'm going to say thanks for being on tonight, and this is so much fun that we're not going to stop, but this is all you're going to hear for now.
That's
so
right.
Tune in next week for more, and I'll see you in the next one. Good night.